Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of the show full of quick conversations concerning what's happening around the state this week. In a few minutes, I'll talk with a woman who made a film about her experience as a sexual assault survivor. The impact of the film that she produced inspired her to produce another one that chronicles the stories of other survivors of sexual assault. But first, an update on Iowa's bullying prevention efforts. For 3 years, Governor Branstad tried to pass anti-bullying laws in the state, none of which made it through the legislature. So last year, he created the state's Office of Bullying Prevention. The director of that center, Alan Heisterkamp, says while the office is having a positive effect on the state, it needs more money before it can accomplish some of its goals. Alan's also the director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa, and he joins me now. Hi, Alan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So give me an idea of what the state of Iowa is dealing with here as far as bullying goes. How much do we know about the bullying that's happening in the state of Iowa?
Well, we know a lot about how bullying is manifest in amongst different populations, you know, youngsters, elementary, adolescent, young adults, or even adults in the workplace for that matter. But, you know, by and large, we can identify what bullying looks like and sounds like. And so the awareness level, I think, has really reached that pinnacle point. And really right now, what the state and what the stakeholders and all those professionals, parents, students are really focused on is how can we prevent it. So really getting into questions, asking each other, how can we institutionalize some of the best practices to address these behaviors and to minimize them or keep them from happening in the first place?
Now, this office, the governor's office, is charged with gathering data on mm-hmm. bullying instances. Do we have any data so far?
You know, data that's reported to the state, in this case, in Iowa, as most states, schools are asked and required to submit bullying incidents to the state Department of Education. And so, quite honestly, when the governor's office on bullying prevention was established here this past fall, one of the first conversations and meetings that was convened took place in Des Moines with Director Ryan Wise and his leadership team, because they have already been, directly involved with collecting data. But we can always become better at doing that, and really helping school districts and the constituents be as accurate as they possibly can. So we can really, pinpoint some, maybe with more specificity, some of the strategies and approaches to prevention. So collecting data really still falls under the umbrella of the Department of Education and the Center for Violence Prevention, and also the Governor's Office on Bullying Prevention will be working together to, really kind of fine-tune those reporting methods so that it does give us accurate information that will help us plan for future trainings, other professional development opportunities, and then ultimately strategies and practices that we can employ and teach and reinforce in our schools and in our communities.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're up against so many challenges because, schools have to report this, but who knows whether kids are actually reporting bullying instances at the schools. And then, you bring cyberbullying into the mix, and that just completely throws off how much we know about how much kids are getting bullied.
It sure does. We know that these types of behaviors, not unlike sexual assault on college campuses or in other organizations, is not reported. Bullying, it would follow the same suit. It is underreported, but we know from polling and from focus groups and having conversations with parents and community stakeholders and students themselves that this is something that is being dealt with every single day, every single week, in school, out of school, in neighborhoods, in homes, in businesses. And, one of the things that I would say that particularly in this particular election year is that we're sending some really conflicting messages about how we as a society, have conversations and discuss and talk about issues that are of importance to all of us. But the tone and the manner in which we discuss and how we talk and refer to other individuals or other groups. Unfortunately, we send some mixed messages. And some of our students who are very active with regards to prevention in their respective schools are making note of this. And there's actually opportunities for them to speak out and to use some of these examples as this is not what we condone, or this is not how we want our school to the students to operate with each other or to relate with each other.
Mm-hmm. There's so much pressure on the schools to handle bullying. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I mean, it is a larger societal issue. There are adults who are bullies. Yeah. And how much are schools kind of conflicted, whether how much they should be involved with something like a cyberbullying incident? How are they handling that?
Right. Well, you know, because of the you know, massive use of and the prevalence of social media and access to smartphones and the technology, certainly it's presented all kinds of challenges that we didn't have or that weren't really in place in schools or other systems in our community at the degree that they are now. But at the same time, social media can be used as a positive way to deter and address and ultimately prevent incidences of bullying and harassment that are online, spreading rumors, stalking, insinuating threats, using demeaning or degrading language. I mean, those do absolutely obviously occur online, just like they do face-to-face in some cases, but that anonymity has really, fueled some of that language. But at the same time, we can become much more instructive and, I believe, informative of using strategies to prevent that. Now, schools have a part of that process of prevention, and I believe education is prevention, and prevention is education. So we as an educational system can play that instruction, teaching, educational component, but we really have to have all layers of, what we call the social ecology. We have to have individuals, peers, friends, families, communities, society. It has to be all of those voices have to be involved in the process. Otherwise, we're not going to see that critical mass or build that capacity to really change those social norms that might support mm-hmm. these types of behaviors.
Now, as director of the governor's anti-bullying office, you're mostly working with lawmakers and schools. But for parents that are listening, they might not know whether their kids are engaged in bullying or being bullied. And even if they do know, what advice do you have for them with navigating this issue and bringing it up with their children?
Sure. Some of the best things that parents can do is what we already know and understand. It's just that at certain times of the developmental process with youngsters, it's more challenging. So checking in and touching base with your kids, whether they are headed out the door to go play with their neighborhood friends, or they're online texting or communicating with someone, asking them where they're at. Where are you going with that? Who are you talking to? Having that conversation, that certainly falls within, the responsibilities of a parent. But we know that relationship, starts to separate naturally in those adolescent years, and which makes it more challenging for parents to really stay connected and to be in touch with and in tune with and asking those questions, where are you headed? Whether you're leaving with the car keys to go out with some friends at night, or whether you're on the computer or on your phone, where are you headed? Where are you going with that? Who are you visiting with? What's going on? And then noticing any types of attitudes and behaviors that seem, atypical for your particular youngster, your son or your daughter. We know the changes that take place physiologically during the adolescent years, but really staying in tune more in touch with your sons and daughters and nieces and nephews or whomever, just having that contact is important. But at the same time, simultaneously, we have the opportunity, though, to really help educate friends, peers, classmates, teammates, so that the conversation happening within those peer groups can be much more more positive, more pro-social, that they can identify and recognize some words, comments, innuendos, or attitudes that really provide a baseline for the abuse or the baseline for the bullying. And if we can nip that in the bud and have get students to challenging those types of comments or words or actions, so we can have a tremendous impact on decreasing, you know, the other overt and the more aggressive behaviors that are often, similar to or found in adolescent and young adult culture.
So at the beginning of the interview, I mentioned the concern over lack of funding, and you've been requesting more funding for the governor's office for bullying prevention. Specifically, you requested $250,000 to fund two full-time staff members. What aren't you doing now that you would be able to do with more money? Where do you see the center going in the future?
Right. Well, there has been. Iowa has been fortunate and has been blessed to have an established group of professionals, primarily using the vehicles of our area education agencies and other professionals who work with bullying and violence prevention, and there's already an infrastructure that is that Iowa has benefited from. What the center and what the new governor's office on bullying prevention could do would be to help systematize and make more consistent throughout the state in all 99 counties best practice support for what is already taking place, but also making sure that we have that our school districts and our other community organizations who serve youth and families, that they have the information, the content, the training, and the expertise to take that and to move it into their respective communities. We want to build a network of professionals, parents, and other stakeholders who have the information that's available. We don't lack information. We don't lack strategies and approaches to prevention. We don't lack that at all. But what we do lack is the implementation and the sustaining, if you will, of those practices in schools, in agencies who serve youth and families. And what the office could do with a bit more funding would be to help systematize and really be much more collaborative and supportive as a technical assistance, but also being able to provide some, really direct instruction, but also to help train and support others as they, facilitate and work in their backyard, quite frankly, in their respective neighborhoods and schools where you really need that local leadership to help support. And then getting our training and educating our students so that they can practice and really, use these strategies and skills with their friends and peers, because that's where the real work happens, is amongst those peer cultures. And so getting this information and treating to them really is a community effort.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, and I'm talking with Alan Heisterkamp. He's the director of the Center for Violence Prevention at UNI. And I'd like you to stay on with us, Alan, as you're also the director of that. We're going to be talking about sexual assault. I'd like to bring in the University of Northern Iowa's Sigma Phi Epsilon president, Jared Ryder, into the conversation. Jared, hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So your fraternity is holding their fourth annual Sexual Assault Awareness Week on campus this week. And this is part of the larger month. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. I'd like to ask you, fraternities are often linked to sexual assault, and many studies have shown links between Greek culture and sexual assault. Do you understand this as a problem within this system and in college campuses in general? How do you see that as a student on campus in a Greek organization?
Yeah, it really is an issue, not just within Greek life, but also on college campuses in general. So we've really kind of set out to be the difference and take that stand to help stop and prevent sexual assault on campuses and make it known that even though we're a Greek organization, we're here to do good things for our campus and give back to the community as well.
What do you feel your role is as a bystander? And I will say potential victim as well. Males can be victims of sexual assault, but largely as a bystander. How do you see that role?
For us, I think it's really to be that leader in any situation, to know what's going on around us and know how to step in or maybe even know what some of the different signs are that sexual assault could be occurring within a relationship, know how to have healthy relationships, and know really how to communicate with others to make it known that sexual assault is an issue.
Have you ever been in a situation where you had to act as a bystander or, you know, have you had connections to victims of sexual assault in some way?
I've never been in a real issue of having to be an active bystander. The biggest issue I've probably had to deal with is when people use the wrong terminology when they're talking about women or they're talking about their relationship. And I think that's kind of where it's my job to step in and let them know that when you start using different type of words and having that culture setting, then it is very just negative, and that's what kind of ultimately leads to sexual assault.
Well, we're running out of time, but briefly, I'd love for you to describe to me this Seesaw project that your fraternity's put together.
Yes. So we do a 24-hour Seesaw to kick off our Sexual Assault Awareness Week. The big purpose behind having the Seesaw is to represent that no matter the time of day, 24 hours, sexual assault happens on campuses, happens within the community, and we really want people to know. We want the victims to know. We want the survivors to know that their voices are going to be heard and that we can help them, and we have resources to help them, and the community is also there to help them.
Alan, do you have any other advice for listeners who would like to become bystanders or would like to, you know, get more information on how to be an effective bystander?
Sure. That's a great question, and thanks for the opportunity to share. We, the Center for Violence Prevention here at Northern Iowa has actually done conducted violence prevention, bullying prevention, and bystander education training to over 50 high school districts and college campuses in Iowa. And folks can Google or email the center, and we can talk more about what that might look like in your respective school or community. But bystander education really is about leadership. And as Jared was sharing, that it's about stepping up and taking a stand and being very clear that sexist, racist, homophobic language is corrosive. It does not bring us together as a community, as society. It tears us apart, and continues to fragment our otherwise unified community and neighborhoods. And so, what Jared and his other fraternity brothers and other students on campus are really doing is really standing up and making very intentional words and actions that say we can be better at preventing forms of abuse, sexual assault being one of them, but it's really a community effort, and it's about leadership.
Jared Ryder and Alan Heisterkamp, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
University of Northern Iowa graduate student Vanessa McNeil first made her film debut about her experience as a sexual assault survivor last summer. The film was called I Am, and the impact was so large that she's followed it up with another film called We Are Survivors that chronicles 8 different survivors' experience with sexual assault. McNeil is traveling to Iowa City tomorrow to screen the film, and she joins me now. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi. So, you know, briefly tell me what happened to you, and then why did you decide to tell your story through film?
Absolutely. So starting around the time I was 4 or 5, my older sister molested me, as well as 2 older female cousins. And when I was 15, I was sexually assaulted by a fellow male student in a college prep program that I had signed up for and was participating in. And I decided to tell my story for various reasons. I felt like it was time for me to share and tell my truth, and I wanted to inspire others to share theirs. And I just feel like it's such an important topic that needs to be talked about, and I just wanted to let other people know that they weren't alone.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that in your first film, I Am, it helped the healing process for you, and are you hoping that it does the same for the 8 survivors and all the viewers who watch We Are Survivors?
Absolutely. My healing really took off after I was open about my experiences. And there's something so powerful about saying something that has been on your heart and mind all of your life. And as for the survivors that were in the film, their healing has improved as well. I remember after we filmed that day in Des Moines, they walked away different people. And since then, they have grown and really opened their wings. And I think it's amazing how much they've changed since they've been open about their life, too.
Mm-hmm. And I hear that you actually had an elderly gentleman come up to you after a screening talking to you about his experience as a sexual assault survivor.
Yeah, and I will never forget that moment. It was so powerful. He just told me that, you know, he was astounded and he really appreciated me coming out with the film and that I was really brave and that he hoped one day he was able to share his truth and be able to be open about the things that has happened in his life. So I thought that that was truly astounding, and it speaks to there's so many people that this is happening to, and for a lot of people they never share. So they're carrying that that guilt and that shame or whatever that may be their entire lives.
So April being Sexual Assault Awareness Month, some people listening may say, yes, I'm aware of sexual assault, but what kind of message do you want people to really hone in on this month and be thinking about?
Absolutely. I would want people to realize that this is happening very frequently. The prevalence is, you know, outlandish, and that it's happening to people that we know, the people we walk past. And it's happening not with people that are jumping out of the bushes or people grabbing us from a white van. It's happening with people that we know, people that we trust, our friends, family members, you know, people that we see in class. It's not the stranger that we should be afraid of. It's happening with people that we know, and I don't think a lot of people really understand that. And I want to say that there was only one survivor in the film that didn't know who her perpetrator was.
Vanessa McNeil is the producer of We Are Survivors, which is being screened tonight in Iowa City, rather tomorrow night in Iowa City at Public Space One. Vanessa, thank you so much for talking with me today and sharing your story.
Thank you. Absolutely.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, a conversation on Iowa's continually increasing cost of living and the fact that it's not keeping up with wages. And Walmart's made a pledge to phase out the sale of eggs from caged hens by 2025. Is this a sustainable promise? And what does it signal about consumer trends and animal products? That's all coming up in just a few minutes on River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury. Stay with us. Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. A new report from the nonprofit Iowa Policy Project shows that the cost of living in Iowa is outpacing wages. Specifically, the report found that a single resident living in Iowa has to make at least $13 an hour to meet basic living expenses. That's almost double the state minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. And if you're a single parent with one child, in order to meet your basic needs, you need to be making $21.52 per hour. Here to help us understand the highlights of this Iowa Policy Project research is Director Peter Fisher. Hello, Peter.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So before we get into the specifics of the report, the numbers, can you paint a picture of what basic needs living is like?
Sure. What we do every 2 years is we try to construct a budget for families of different sizes and types with just the basic expenses for child care, clothing and other household expenses, food, health insurance, rent, and transportation. And we're looking at a no-frills budget, no vacations, no meals outside the home, no savings for college, just what you need to get by in Iowa.
Wow. So So make sense of this for me. You know, the minimum wage in the state is $7.25 per hour. This is so much more than that to meet those basic living expenses that you just mentioned, excluding savings and that sort of thing. How did you arrive at that number?
Well, we look at a variety of sources. The USD, for USDA, Department of Agriculture, for example, has a basic food budget. The housing, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development knows what rents are in each county. We can look up on the exchange and find out health insurance premiums, et cetera. And we put that together for these different families. And, you know, you look at, a two-parent family with two children, the parents both working full-time, we're looking at $60,000 a year is what they need to meet this basic budget. And in order to get that, they're going to have to earn about $70,000 because they're going to have to pay about $10,000 a year in income and payroll taxes to leave them with the $60,000 to cover all these other basic expenses.
Mm-hmm. Now, nationally, Iowa is kind of known as an affordable place to live compared to, let's say, living in Chicago and Illinois. But we're seeing a lot of cities in Iowa on these, you know, top 10 places to live, top 10 places for millennials. Is that a part of this? Is kind of the rural or the urban growth in Iowa contributing to the rise in cost of living here?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you look at where the costs of living are higher, where they're lower. If you look, for example, at child care and rent, it is the cities, the metro areas, that tend to have the higher costs. On the other hand, if you look at transportation and health care, it's the rural areas that have the high costs. They've got longer commutes, longer travel times to get to shopping, et cetera. And health insurance premiums are substantially higher in rural areas than they are in the big cities. So it kind of balances out. You end up with the high-cost parts of the state being, for example, Johnson County, to a lesser extent Polk County, because of child care costs and rent, but also the southeast corner of the state.
Mm-hmm. Nationwide, it's been estimated that one in four low-income families, they pay more than 70% of their income on rent. How does affordable housing factor into this?
Well, it's something we certainly need. We don't take public housing programs into account, in part because they are pretty spotty and there tend to be waiting lists. Oftentimes of years, so it's not something that people can count on in terms of getting any kind of rent subsidies. So affordability really just depends on, you know, if you live in a place where the rents are relatively low, you're lucky. Otherwise, you know, it can be a big chunk of your income.
Mm. Do you see local city officials kind of making moves on creating more affordable housing, or is this something we're just kind of talking about, but there's not a lot of action on it yet?
Yeah, I don't have a good sense of that statewide. There certainly are things that localities are trying to do, right? I don't know how that stacks up against the need for affordable housing statewide. There's certainly others that could address that better than I could.
Mm-hmm. Well, Johnson County will take that county as an example. It's raising its minimum wage up to $10.10 January of next year. That still doesn't meet what the Iowa Policy Project report says is basic living expenses, that $13.16 an hour. Do you think it's a step in the right direction?
Well, certainly it's a step in the right direction. I mean, we're talking about a pretty substantial boost in income for a lot of low-wage workers. And if you're at the minimum wage, you know, and another, it's almost $3 an hour if you're working full-time. That's, you know, that's another $6,000 a year, and that's certainly, that's real money. That's going to move them certainly much closer to something like self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any places that had the lowest overall cost of living in Iowa?
Well, the overall costs tend to be lowest in four eastern Iowa metro areas, Waterloo, Cedar Falls, Dubuque, Cedar Rapids, and Davenport, you know, it's still not cheap. It's still a cost of living well above the minimum wage and above, for most families, actually the median wage in Iowa, which is around $16 an hour. In other words, half the jobs in Iowa don't pay enough for a lot of families, particularly if they have children, have daycare expenses for a lot of them to get by.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Dubuque, you know, Davenport. Is there anything we can learn from these places, even though, as you said, they're still, you know, if you're living on minimum wage, you're still not getting by?
Well, that's a good question. I hadn't really thought about that. I'm not sure what we can learn in terms of public policy, or whether it's more a matter of, you know, economics, what's happening in the housing market, et cetera, mm-hmm. And you know, their ability to have somewhat lower health insurance rates certainly helps, I think, in those places.
Peter Fisher, director of the Iowa Policy Project. Peter, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. For a long time, cancer researchers have observed a seeming correlation between cancer and autism. Many of the same genes are implicated in both. And recently, research from the University of Iowa was published in the journal PLOS ONE, and it shows that autistic patients have significantly higher rates of DNA variation in genes that potentially cause cancer. Here to help us understand this finding is one of the study's authors, Dr. Ben Darbro. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Darbro, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So cancer and autism, these are two things that easily elicit fear. What does this study tell us about their connection?
Well, the study tells us that the two appear to be connected at a genetic level, and also at a epidemiologic or sort of a patient level as well, patient diagnosis level. And the association that we found at both of these levels was very strong, especially strong at the genetic level, reaching a very, very strong level of statistical significance.
So does that mean that people who have autism are more likely to get cancer?
Well, see, that's where things got very interesting during our study, is that whereas we did find that there was a link or an association between autism and cancer at the genetic level, and whereas we actually had hypothesized that patients with autism would get cancer more often, we actually found the opposite. Patients with autism actually develop cancer less often.
So what are some of the implications that come from this study?
Well, I think the two big implications are that what we learn from autism might actually help to inform new cancer treatments, and many of the cancer treatments that have been the product of billions of dollars of research and decades of investigation might someday actually be used in the treatment of autism.
Can you give an example?
Certainly. So in the cancer field, one of the products of all of these years of research and funding have been these what we call targeted therapies. So these are drugs that are very specific as to the cellular signaling pathways that they interact with and usually inhibit. Now, because we found that so many of the genes that are implicated in cancer were also found to have DNA variation in patients with autism, the hope is that perhaps someday one of these very targeted anti-cancer drugs or treatments could be used to modulate the same pathway, but in somebody with autism, such that it might actually restore sort of normal neurodevelopment and potentially even you know, alleviate or modulate some of the neurocognitive and social impairments that go along with autism.
You know, you hope that in the future there could be a little bit more prevention for those with autism.
Right. So the idea would be that at some point science may be advanced enough that we would be able to determine from a genetic test, potentially in a pregnant woman or even in a brand newborn baby, that they have genetic variations that predispose them, or, you know, that we might be very confident are going to lead to autism. And at that point in time, we could actually intervene with a medication to sort of inhibit the mutations or the defects that are there to restore normal brain and neural development.
So what's the next step for you and other researchers? What are you looking at now?
So the biggest thing that we want to do as a follow-up to this study is to repeat it in another population. So we were able to do this using publicly available data, genetic data, as well as our own University of Iowa hospitals and clinic patient records. So what we really want to do is go to another academic medical center and try and do the exact same thing and see if this relationship continues to hold at the patient level. The other thing that we'd really like to do is to really take a much closer look at the mutations or the DNA variations that we found within the cancer-causing genes in autistic individuals to see whether or not these mutations might be the type that are much more typical in cancer, i.e. they're turning on the cancer genes, or if it might be a very special type of mutation that is actually inhibiting or sort of turning off these cancer-causing genes. And that actually might explain why individuals with autism develop cancer less often.
Big implications here. Very interesting. The correlation between cancer and autism. University of Iowa research was published last month in the journal Plus One. Dr. Ben Darbrow was one of the study's authors. Dr. Darbrow, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. The nation's largest grocery chain, Walmart, is the latest company to announce that it's going cage-free with its eggs. Their plan is to buy and sell only cage-free eggs by 2025. Amy Mayer is an agriculture reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media, and she joins me now to talk about this move. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Emily.
So Iowa produces the most eggs out of any state in the country. We have about 50 million hens, and I think nearly one in every five eggs consumed in the country actually comes from Iowa. But how much of the industry is cage-free?
Well, right now, the most recent estimate I saw said that approximately 6% of eggs that are sold in the U.S. today are coming from cage-free hen environments.
Okay. And have you been to a cage-free egg-laying facility?
I have not. I shouldn't say that. I was at a free-range egg operation about 2 years ago. It was a small-scale, serving only central Iowa place where the hens actually could get up and walk around. They went outside. They came inside. They had nest boxes. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about cage-free eggs. The cage-free eggs that places like Walmart and Costco and Denny's and Starbucks will be sourcing are going to come from some of the large egg producers like we have here. Rembrandt Foods in Spirit Lake, Iowa, for example, is one of the few of the largest producers that's actually stepped up to say we're transitioning to cage-free. And a cage-free barn for them would still look to us as something more like a cage environment. The animals will still not be allowed to go outside. They will have enough room to fly. They'll be able to spread their wings and they'll be able to move around, but it wouldn't look like your sort of storybook picture of a barnyard full of hens.
Mm-hmm. And how are animal rights activists kind of looking at this? Because in one sense, it seems to be a step forward, more cage-free hens laying eggs. But at the same time, like you said, it's not so different from what it was because, you know, to meet this growing demand of cage-free eggs, you know, you need to have a lot of hens in one space.
Right. When I spoke with one of the people from the Humane Society who had been spearheading this effort, he was thrilled that so many places were signing on and yet didn't hesitate to point out they would still like to see better conditions for all hens. I think the part that the Humane Society and the other animal welfare advocates don't want to talk about is that the natural living environment for hens includes pecking order. That's where we get the term. They peck at each other. And so there are some concerns with the actual well-being of the hens in this cage-free environment. The other thing I'd like to say is that it is groups like HSUS, the Humane Society of the U.S., that have brought us to this point. I mean, it was really high on their agenda, and they helped very much to sway consumer demand, and it was that consumer demand that ultimately pushed many of these companies.
Mm-hmm. And many of these companies include McDonald's and Burger King have made these promises, and now Walmart. Can supply keep up with this demand if this trend continues?
It's going to take a while. And when you read through the headlines, you'll see it says, you know, Walmart going cage free, and then it will say in smaller print by 2025. I think Starbucks' commitment is by 2020. Right now, none of these huge food endeavors could source all of their eggs from what they've defined as a cage-free environment. There just aren't enough of them being produced. But as barns are replaced, as new hen housing is built, it's going to be filling that need by providing these new types of housing to replace the old cages.
Mm-hmm. Now, last year, the avian flu, I think in Iowa, about 30 million hens were euthanized. And you followed this last year. Is the industry recovered from this? How does this impact the conversation we're having now about cage-free eggs?
Two separate questions. I would say most of the barns where birds had to be euthanized and entire flocks had to be culled are well on their way, if not already back at capacity. There is a lag between, well, first the lag is getting the new birds in, and then the lag is getting those hens up to their full expected production potential. So estimates were that we actually wouldn't see a complete recovery until perhaps later this year or even early next year, although there may be more recent estimates than I have on hand. In terms of whether the bird flu outbreak has influenced these cage-free decisions, I thought that there might be a connection. When I did my story about cage-free eggs in December, I really thought surely some of these places that had to cull their barns are going to be like, hey, let's use a new system now. But actually, it turns out in order to put up these kinds of cage-free systems, it's most cost-effective to just build a new barn from scratch. And that wasn't required to recover from bird flu. So there's not as much of a correlation as you might expect.
Okay. And should we be worried about the bird flu, or is it completely over? Where do we go looking forward?
There always is bird flu in the environment. And so certainly it could come back at any time. So far in 2016, we had a very isolated outbreak of a different strain of avian influenza in Indiana, and it did not spread widely. I think most producers are still very much on edge, and lots of researchers are still trying to figure out just exactly what happened last summer. But I guess it's a wait and see sort of situation.
Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media and Iowa Public Radio reporter. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Emily.
And finally, 8035 has announced the lineup for their ninth year as a festival this week. And here to discuss it with me is festival organizer Amadeo Rossi. Hi, Amadeo.
Hi there.
So, 9 years of the festival. What are your hopes this year?
Well, this is our ninth live. We're doing a cat theme, and I hope we can make it to a tenth year. So,
a cat theme. Interesting. Yeah. Why the cat theme?
Well, I just nine lives, ninth year. So we just did that theme. Each year we take some sort of iconic thing to associate with the festival, and this year it's cats.
Okay, interesting. Well, you got the Decemberists headlining as well as Nas. Who else are you excited about?
Well, I think Wolf Parade, who is a reunited rock band out of Canada, is really exciting. Electronic jam band Lotus, the Black Lips, who are out of Atlanta, kind of a punk garage scene band. We have Jeff Austin Band, who he was part of Yonder Mountain, so some folks. So we always have a little bit of little jam and a little indie, some bluegrass, and on we go.
Mm. Well, last year you had the hip-hop rap group Run the Jewels performing in a lineup that contained a lot of, you know, indie rock and alternative artists. And this year you have the well-known rap artist Nas headlining the event. Are you trying to branch out to serve kind of larger Iowa music tastes?
Well, I think that when it takes, you know, like in hip-hop is something that's fundamental to people that are, you know, even in their later 30s and 40s. So we've had that from the beginning. The Roots have played, Public Enemy has played, and we've had a lot of fundamental groups that have been involved.
Amadeo Rossi, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about 8035.
Thank you.
All right. And we're going to go out with some music from the Decemberists, who are headlining this year's 8035 Festival. You can check out that lineup online. This is The Crane Wife from the Decemberists off their 2006 album. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is produced by IPR.
I'll clothe in a snowy shroud. She had no heart so hard.